this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Because what they're really trying to do is take her law license. If they take her law license, then they take her dignity. If they take her dignity, then they take away the community's hope.
Supporters of former Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby are calling the case against her an egregious tragedy of justice.
It's important to keep the heat on your local. And the way to do that is to constantly build information amongst the workers about the layoffs.
UPS says it has plans to reduce the number of workers by 100,000 using AI and robotics in their warehouses. Unionists are fighting back.
143 out of 193 nations say we want to recognize Palestine as a state and give it the rights of membership that are afforded other states, and yet it's not going to move forward.
While the UN General Assembly votes to accept Palestine as its 194th member, Israel aggressively bombs Rafah.
There is nothing typical about 15,000 children live-streamed deaths being watched. And there is nothing acceptable about our institutional complicity, silence, or the gross misuse of police force nationwide. The world is in desperate need of change, and we must be the ones to do it.
Palestinian-American law student Maha Zeidan gives a powerful speech at the University of Toledo Graduate School Commencement Ceremony. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Activists around the country have rallied to stop the persecution of black women prosecutors. Baltimore State's attorney Marilyn Mosby is facing 40 years in prison on trumped-up charges initiated by the Trump Justice Department. Host of Human Rights and Justice radio show Nikichi Taifa and political commentator and podcast host Angela Rai share more about the case of Marilyn Mosby, which they call an egregious tragedy of justice.
Can you just tell us just a little bit why all these strong black women have come together to support our sister Marilyn Mosby?
There are black women all over the country who know what it's like to be targeted, to know what it's like to be wrongfully convicted, to know what it's like to face serious repercussions when you do the right thing. And so what I think struck a chord in many of us is I could do something all the way right, all the way by the book. We know we have to be above reproach. We know our elders told us that we have to be twice as good. So when you do all of those things and you still get targeted and you are still profiled and you are still basically tarnished in the press, it really messes with your psyche. You're like, am I that good? Did I really have these accomplishments? You look at the body of work of a Marilyn Mosby, and knowing that even if the prosecution of the officers who killed Freddie Gray, who murdered Freddie Gray, was not successful, what she did that was successful is give prosecutors all over the country the gall and the courage to prosecute police officers who normally would just get off. You know, I don't know that we would have a conviction post George Floyd if it weren't for the courage of a Marilyn Mosby. And so to me, what is remarkable about this moment are the people who could look at Marilyn Mosby and say, I am Marilyn Mosby. Mm-hmm. You know, justice is ours. That is our birthright. Fairness is ours. Equality is ours. Freedom is ours. That's our birthright. And even though we know that we haven't realized that yet in this country, we know that if we don't fight for it, we're going to lose even more ground. What they're doing, what the United States Department of Justice has done in targeting with a selective and malicious prosecution case against Marilyn Mosby is send a message to black women, to black children, to black men, to our siblings to say, if you want to be an attorney and you decide you want to take on the system, we got news for you. So if they are successful with Marilyn here, we don't have any hope of justice in other states and other cities and other jurisdictions because we know that our folks are going to be afraid. Who's going to protect them? Who's going to have their backs? Right. And we don't need anybody else feeling skeptical about this system. Going into this election, I've never felt so afraid about our people and where they're going to stand and how they're going to vote. But people are feeling very skeptical, doubting about whether or not this system serves them, covers them, is working against, working on their best interest and for their best interest. We've got to collectively ensure that our demands make sure that this administration and other bodies of government from state to local on down prove it. Every other constituency in this country has a right to demand but us. We are so often taken for granted that we can't even make our needs made clear, that we can't bring our petitions to you and our demands to you without you saying, how dare you? Oh, we have every right because our taxpayer dollars pay you. You know, we have every right. And so right now we're skeptical about a Justice Department that we know has tried our folks, you know, has tarnished their image. That has been the legacy of this Justice Department. So until there's a mission reset, we know that we have to hold them accountable. And that's what's happening here. We know what it is. We've seen it before. And if we weren't here for it, we read about it in history books. We've seen it in documentaries. We know what it's capable of.
Right. So we have definitely, like you said, need to hold this system accountable. And I know that there is a recent civil rights letter that has gone up to President Biden asking for certain things. Can you just very briefly say what's in the letter or just what the case is against Marilyn Mosby and what we are asking President Biden to do?
Yeah, so Marilyn Mosby is facing 40 years in federal prison for taking out her own money from her retirement account. She withdrew money from her retirement account to purchase property. And they decided that Marilyn did not experience an adverse financial consequence as defined by the CARES Act because they count in her pockets, because they know who she's responsible for in her family. I mean, come on, Black women. We know how, if you are making six figures, you are probably the breadwinner in your family and responsible for more than just your household. Like, we understand that. They don't understand that. So she's trying to ensure that she's setting up her family for success because she sees they're coming after her seat as a prosecutor. So she's like, okay, I can't bank on this forever. Let me make sure I'm having other streams of income. I'm a first generation college student. I'm taking care of everybody, including her grandmother, who is in hospice right now. So she's got to look out for everyone. And she did just that. She called to get advice, just like a lawyer would do, right? To ensure that she wasn't violating any rules, that she was going by the book, all of that. The other thing that happened was she was told by her mortgage broker that they could not receive an earnest money deposit from her bank account that she shares with her daughter because a minor was attached to it. So they asked her if she could get the money from her husband. Marilyn says yes, but she also knew that Nick may not have the money, but she said yes to the broker because that's not his business. And spouses can, you know, transfer money to each other all the time. Parents can transfer money to their kids all the time. Kids can transfer money to their parents all the time. It's not illegal. She transferred money to Nick for this deposit, and he transferred money later. He moved things around from his Robinhood account, all these other things. He transferred money to the mortgage broker. The Department of Justice said she used that to secure a lower interest rate. Her interest rate was locked for 3 weeks before any of that happened. So it's just patently false. They lied in the indictment. So all in all, and catchy, we're talking about $95,000 of Marilyn's own money. So there's no crime, and she certainly should not be facing 40 years in federal prison or any prison, because what they're really trying to do is take her law license. If they take her law license, then they take her dignity. If they take her dignity, then they take away the community's hope. We can't go for any of that. We're going to fight this all the way.
So, you know, the interesting thing about all this is that it really isn't about the real estate or the money or the property or anything along those lines. It is retaliation.
That's it.
For her standing up as a progressive prosecutor and holding police officers accountable. And I think that that's the bottom line. And I think it started with Freddie Gray and her indicting those officers. You know, as we're coming down to close, give us just a little bit of view of that in terms of the real reasons why this Black woman is being targeted and fairly prosecuted and about to be sentenced in a couple of weeks, you know, which is the really, really sad part about it. So tell about her progressive policies as a prosecutor. As far as I'm concerned, in my humble opinion, one of the key reasons why she's in this situation she's in right now.
Absolutely. I would say you could look at Maryland's groundbreaking decision not to prosecute marijuana cases, right? Her groundbreaking decision to not prosecute nonviolent offenses during the COVID pandemic, her desire to look review cases that were directly or indirectly attached to something called the Gun Trace Task Force in Maryland. She had 2,100 cases reviewed and over 800 cases vacated for, folks who should not have been prosecuted probably to begin with because the cops were corrupt. That is Maryland's work. She had the support of many in the state legislature, but she made three enemies. And I've identified three main people that I think folks should pay attention to. If you're saying, oh, no, something must be wrong. It's about Baltimore. It's an elected official. It's money. Look this up, because I did that, too, because I was being a bigot. I had to check myself and I had to do my own research. First name, Leo Wise. If you look up Leo Wise and the Congressional Black Caucus, you'll see that he didn't start targeting elected officials when he got to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland. He did it on Capitol Hill, and somehow he disappeared and found himself in the United States Attorney's Office in Maryland. At one point on Capitol Hill, Leo had 8 open ethics investigations. All of them were CBC members. At that time, we were less than 50 in the House of Representatives. We ain't that corrupt. Everybody not that unethical. You have a targeting problem, sir. When he went to Maryland, he did the same thing. The next person, Larry Hogan. Governor Larry Hogan had so many public back and forth issues with Marilyn Mosby. He told her that he was going to defund her office. He tried to make a mockery out of her regularly. And somehow, when he got wind that she was under investigation for this COVID-related fraud from the CARES Act, where she withdrew her own money from her retirement account, the governor decided that he was going to give money to the U.S. Department of Justice's office in Maryland to prosecute fraud cases. When have you ever heard of a governor giving additional resources to the U.S. Attorney's office? Come on. Then on top of that, you have Donald Trump. It was right after George Floyd passed and into the summer when folks were still protesting. He threatened to sue federal law enforcement into cities all over this country. One of them was Maryland. And Maryland and Larry Krasner from Philadelphia got together and they wrote an op-ed. All of this is searchable. I've checked my facts before I bring it to y'all. They wrote an op-ed together and they said, if you send your federal officers to our cities, we will prosecute them. Do you know 2 months later, Maryland was under federal investigation? Leo Wise also donated to Maryland's political opponents. He had animus towards her. He was retaliating against her. She was under federal investigation for 5+ years. They couldn't find anything until they created this manufactured claim. Leo Wise was not removed from her case for a material conflict. It is a material conflict to be donating to the person you're prosecuting's political opponents.
Opposition.
That's very clear. That is textbook. So we also need to be looking at filing a complaint with the Office of Professional Responsibility and probably figuring out what repercussions exist for this judge, because she should not have ruled against that. That is basic, right? This is a no-brainer conflict. So there's a lot at stake here. Maryland has a tremendous track record, and it's one that people are intimidated by, particularly those in power, particularly those at justice, particularly those who didn't want to ruffle any feathers or rock any boats. That's what we're up against.
In closing, what is it that we're asking? What are we asking Biden? What are we asking the judge? What can the public do to try to right this wrong?
Yes, there are three things that I would ask. The first thing is there is a petition where we are seeking a pardon for Marilyn Mosby. That petition can be found on justiceformarilynmosby.com. We are also asking folks, if you are able and if you stand with us, Marilyn is scheduled to be sentenced on May 23rd in Baltimore at 10:30 a.m. Come to the sentencing hearing. Come show your support. Let that judge see a courtroom full of people who stand with her and her very important legacy. I think the last thing that's important to do is call the White House. While we're collecting signatures for the petition, the White House is 202-456-1111. Call President Biden and say, we demand a pardon for Marilyn Mosby. It is the right thing to do. She pursued justice in the ways in which you said you will now seek justice. You can't punish someone who went after courageously those who were corrupt in the system, those folks who were poisoning the system and making life more difficult for us. She was balancing the scales of justice. If we want to ensure our success, our viability, our protection, our equality, our equity in this country, we got to stand with Marilyn, because justice for her is justice for all of us.
Thank you so much, Angela Rye, for joining Human Rights and Justice. And we look forward to a very favorable outcome of this very unjust prosecution. Thank you so much for joining us. Stand with Marilyn Mosby.
It's my honor. Thank you.
Marilyn Mosby served as the state's attorney for Baltimore from 2015 to 2023. She gained national attention following the 2015 police killing of Freddie Gray when she led the charge to prosecute the officers responsible for his death. We thank attorney and host of Human Rights and Justice talk show, Nikichi Taifa, for this report. And I could cry. That was Hozier, Nina Cried Power. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Following the Teamsters United Parcel Service contract, over 12,000 mostly part-time workers were permanently laid off. UPS says it has plans to reduce the number of workers by 100,000 using AI and robotics in their warehouses. Portland IBT 162 UPS worker Tony Cochran spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the layoffs.
So we've been organizing. Independent Teamsters Organizing Committee has been fighting on this issue. And we had some interesting news from the week past that there was a layoff the week before last of people who were supposedly protected. And then the next day they were back. So we began to ask questions as to how this happened. Based on reasonable and good sources, we learned that the union, the local, directly intervened, according to these reports, and told the company to reduce the hours and bring back these laid off workers. This is unprecedented because, as Ben Vitas has told us numerous times, they don't get involved in the operations of the company. That's management's right. So we have to ask ourselves, what changed? Well, there are political pressures on the local here. And I think that a lot of that pressure may have led to this direct, unprecedented intervention to bring back these laid off workers. I think at one point there were 29 and 21 of them came back the next day, despite the fact they were told they wouldn't be coming back until the following Monday. So it's important to keep the heat on your local. And the way to do that is to constantly build information amongst the workers about the layoffs, is to talk to your coworkers, is to build these committees, these independent organizing committees, so that people have a voice, a counter power, if you will, between the union and the company, because oftentimes they have their own interests that are not in the interests of the rank and file. And it's important for the rank and file to have their own organizing committee, their own structures. It's difficult, but it's very, very important. The other thing is we need to have forums on this, and some of that can be independently organized. And in some locals, that can be organized by the union leaders. It depends on the type of leadership one has. Right now, we have a paucity of good leaders in the Teamsters. In fact, our leadership is quite weak when it comes to AI and automation. We see this as a defining moment. UPS Teamsters are the largest private sector bargaining unit in North America, 300 and some odd thousand. If the venture capitalists who own UPS and the stock shareholders who push these policies can dismantle and dismember the largest single bargaining unit in North America, private sector, which controls the logistics, is huge. I mean, it's 6% of the nation's GDP. If they can dismantle this between now and the next contract, it will weaken the labor movement. It will weaken our ability to organize. It will also leave those of us who perhaps have seniority left with less power on the shop floor because robots will have taken the jobs of our coworkers, and less security when it comes to pensions and healthcare. So it's a very, very critical issue, which is unfortunately not being addressed at all by our leadership. And the reasons are the fact that right now the union has made this deal and they've called it historic. And if they were to say there are problems with it, it would really tarnish their legitimacy. And that's just a fact.
And as you know, and we've been talking about, this is affecting all workers in the country. One of the issues is, of course, power. Who's going to control the introduction of technology? Who is technology and AI going to benefit? And under this system, capitalism, the billionaires really control that technology, and it's used to benefit them. You think it raises the question of the working class having control and power over the introduction of technology, AI, so it will benefit workers and not the billionaires?
Absolutely. You know, I was listening to an interview yesterday with Jaron Lanier, the father of virtual reality, and he's been very techno-skeptical. He used to be kind of a techno-utopian, but he's changed. And he talked a lot about these issues. We live in a market economy. How do we address this issue? So with AI, it's important to get these definitions right. AI being artificial intelligence. AGI being artificial general intelligence. So what is the difference? Artificial intelligence, we have it, we use it every single day. It's in your phone, Tesla Autopilot, Siri on your iPhone. We use it. Artificial general intelligence is the next level. It is when AI becomes ubiquitous and begins to speak with each other. It's the information network of things. And you can think of it kind of like a collective conscious. This is very important that people begin to understand this in the working class, because we are about to enter this realm of artificial general intelligence, which is the next step. There's a lot of talk in Silicon Valley about what they call AI alignment, an alignment of AI or AGI with our, quote, human values. Now, what they mean by AI alignment is an alignment with their values, with the values of the ruling class, right? Well, AI won't kill us all, right? AI won't destroy the planet. AI won't kill them. This is the concern that they have with superintelligence, which is basically AI when it becomes sentient, which is down the road. So when we talk about AI alignment from a Silicon Valley tech bro experience, that's what they're talking about. When we talk about a working class AI alignment, we're talking about workers controlling AI, AGI, and the direction in which that is going through regulation, through negotiation, but through also direct intervention in the process. Because if we want the alignment to work, it has to work for everyone. And in fact, we could use this to end the class divisions that exist. Of course, they don't want to do that. Their AI alignment is more and more money for people at the top and less for people at the bottom. The AI alignment that we want to see as working class people is the elimination of class distinctions and full worker control over this technology.
And how can that happen? How could that debate even happen? Because it seems like it's being put out there. And what workers are being told is that these companies will decide how this is being introduced. And there's really no regulation. Both the Democrats and Republicans are controlled by these tech billionaires. There's some regulation in Europe, but the trend in the United States is the wild, wild west, let it rip.
Yeah.
And that is apparently what's happening now at UPS in eliminating over 10,000 jobs and many more on the chopping block.
Correct. Labor unions are woefully unprepared for this. And I talk about Ned Ludd a lot. The Luddites get tarnished, but really what they were doing was fighting for control over their labor.
And that was the Industrial Revolution we talk about.
That was the Industrial Revolution, yeah. So we're talking 19th century. Ned Ludd, he gets talked about as if, you know, oh, you just want to go back to steam engines and all of that. That's the boss's message, right? These technologies don't just come from, you know, deus ex machina. They're not just coming out of the sky. You know, these are not natural phenomena. They're social phenomena, just like the economy. The problem, I think, with our thinking is that we view the thing of the economy and technology as if it's some, you know, geology, right? As if it's just natural. This is like air. Getting people to think about these things as social realities is important. Unions could play a big role in that, and they should, because if they don't, they're digging their own graves, really. The only way to do that is to dismantle the union bureaucracy that exists today, because it's woefully unprepared. It's shown itself to be morally bankrupt, but worse than being morally bankrupt, it is completely complicit in this process of dismantling workers' rights. Now, that may seem paradoxical because unions are supposed to be fighting for workers' rights. But if you're not fighting for control of these technologies, then you are inevitably handing all of that to the ruling class. And so we have to have a real big discussion about how these unions work and if they're fit for purpose in the 21st century. And if they're not, then how do we create counterpowers within them to revolutionize the organized and organize the unorganized? And I think this is going to be very important as we move forward.
That was IBT Local 162 UPS Teamster Tony Cochran speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. You can find out more about his Independent Teamsters Organizing Committee at independentteamsterorganizingcommittee.org.
Hey, we going on strike. We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike.
For real.
Till they get this right.
Come on.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
All day.
We going on strike.
All night.
Till they get this right.
Look. Come on.
We going on strike, so you better listen. We ain't about to keep working under these conditions.
Facts.
Working in a hot plant with no air
conditioning.
And they got the nerve to tell us that this fair conditions.
Yeah, right.
They don't work they off, they gon' get fired.
Facts.
Temps working like slaves and don't get hired.
Come on.
The supervisor don't care if they get tired.
They
just trying to make sure them sales get hired.
Keep going.
The union gotta stick together, do this for each other.
Do
this one for all my sisters, do this for our brothers.
Cause
they trying to treat us wrong, but they say they love us.
Real.
We need a change right now, we ain't going further.
Yes.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike tonight.
That was GMAC Cash on strike. This week, thousands of auto workers at Mercedes-Benz Alabama plant will be voting on whether the United Auto Workers Union will represent them. The recent victory of UAW at Volkswagen in an overwhelming vote is a sign of a growing tide of union organizing in the South for the first time since the 1930s. The UAW wants to organize 150,000 auto workers, mostly in the South, and that would not only change the labor movement, but transform the U.S. Already, three Southern governors have warned that this union drive must be stopped. UAW President Sean Fain has also said he wants all UAW contracts to expire on May Day 2028, and for other unions to join together for a general strike. Sean Fain spoke at the Labor Notes conference in Chicago about these recent victories and what they pretend.
The UAW, our mission, you know,
I'm like everyone in this room. I was a frustrated member for 29 years of my career, and felt like, didn't feel like I know. The mission when I was elected was to do one thing. It was to change a culture of company unionism and get it back to a member-led, member-driven union. We've had to undo decades of going backwards due to company unionism. And you know, our biggest issues in the Big Three fight, and really all of our fights coming up, with inflation, was addressing cost of living allowance. It was the wage increases that were needed. Our wages went backwards. In a decade of record profits of these corporations, our wages went backwards. It's inexcusable. Retirement security, retirement insecurity is a massive issue in this nation. And healthcare, of course, the healthcare crisis, of the free world, we rank like 26th in healthcare, which is criminal in the wealthiest nation in the world. And then also in auto, the battery EV transition that was basically the way it was set up when I was elected was set up as a race to the bottom. And it was interesting throughout this fight. I mean, and even getting into this fight, we were told, over and over, you can't bargain for retirees. You can't get cost of living back. You can't bring the battery work under the master agreement. After we finished the bargaining, we talked about organizing, moving on to organizing, and growing this union, and bringing workers power and control of their lives. We were told you can't organize in the South. Our goal was to drive out the fear that these companies, the billionaire class and corporate class play upon, because that's how they win. They divide us, and they want to make people afraid of standing up for themselves and fighting to win justice. And my mission from day one was to get rid of the word can't, because can't is a company unionism phrase, and that's where it belongs. We have to believe we can. And if we did one thing, we have, and we will continue to do this. We won those things. We did. We did win get cost of living back. We did win record pay increases. We did bargain for retirees, contrary to what people said. We did get the EV battery industry reined in. And we sure as hell won a major victory when we just organized a bunch of groupers at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And one thing that really goes unnoticed in that, and I know Jane talked about this last night, it was one of the proudest things I've ever seen, because of the badass team of people that I was able to bring on board and get in this fight with us, this badass group of troublemakers, was, we were able to make the companies pay striking workers for being on strike, and we came up with what we coined the terms of surrender. And we actually have signed contracts with GM, Ford, and Stellantis, all three. Each one, we signed a term of surrender agreement where it is actually stated terms of surrender of the plants that were on strike. I'll tell you, Friday was a very, I get emotional even thinking about it right now, and even hearing you all, that response, we talk about Volkswagen, but to be in the room with those organizers and with the volunteer organizing committee members, to be in the room to watch the NLRB count those ballots and watch those stacks of 50 yes votes pile up over and over, it was an ultimate experience to see those workers, to have met with those workers through this process and know the pain they've been through for a decade of being beat down and told they can't and not getting the adequate support they should have got from our level. They got it, and to be there at that moment, to see these workers win justice, it's nothing I'll ever forget in my life. And we got our missions continue that. We're gonna kick ass. We have an election slated for Mercedes in the middle of May. They're next in line. We gotta get back to the philosophy of Dr. Martin Luther King when he said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And yeah. Same as, when we tie it to the working class, we have to adopt that phrase, an injustice to workers anywhere is a threat to justice to workers everywhere. So we've had these sweatshirts and shirts made this week, and this was part of my speech when the president visited striking workers on the picket line for the first time in our history. So it was a site called Willow Run where we made Liberator bombers during World War II. It was part of the arsenal of democracy. And so when I spoke about that on strike, we thought it would be a great thing to make these shirts and sweatshirts up to remind us of what we are and who we are. It's a new day in the UAW. I won't speak for all organized labor, but I'll speak for us. And I said this during that speech, that working class people are the arsenal of democracy. The enemy isn't some far off country. The enemy is one thing, it's corporate greed. And the workers are the liberators.
That was UAW President Sean Fain on the victory of VW auto workers to join the UAW and the drive to organize the South.
We knew in the 1980s, chaos, catastrophe was on the way. Plants shutting down like crazy. The moment was coming, that's here today. Working class children and babies, the world's been stolen and laid to waste. Future generation's gonna say to me, did you stand up and show your face? Rise and fight, let's unite. Militant unions are what I like. Raise your voice, got no choice. Time for a general strike.
That was Mike Stout singing Time for a General Strike. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. On Friday, May 10th, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution accepting Palestine as a member. Pacifica's Don DeBar spoke to human rights and labor lawyer Dan Kovalik.
The UN General Assembly Friday passed a resolution accepting Palestine as its 194th member. This follows a Security Council veto by the U.S. last month on the same question. Palestine has been a non-voting observer in the body since 2012. The new resolution would grant it, quote, new rights and privileges, closed quote, as well as full membership if it's approved by the Security Council. The General Assembly vote was 143 in favor, 9 against, and 25 abstentions. The U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood said Washington is opposed to the resolution and indicated it would veto Palestinian membership again at the Council. The resolution Friday included an expression of, quote, deep regret and concern, close quote, by the General Assembly about the U.S. veto last month. Friday's resolution included the General Assembly's, quote, unwavering support for the two-state solution of Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace and security within recognized borders based on the pre-1967 borders, close quote. Israel's Ambassador Gilad Erdan accused the General Assembly of, quote, shredding the U.N. Charter with his vote, closed quote. He proceeded to feed a copy of the document through a paper shredder that he had brought to the podium. Meanwhile, Israeli tanks, which entered the city of Rafah in southern Gaza earlier this week, moved to secure the city. Rafah currently holds some 1.4 million Palestinian refugees displaced from other parts of Gaza as a result of Israeli airstrikes and ground attacks since October 7th. The UN had warned that an Israeli invasion would be a catastrophe for civilians. President Biden had threatened to stop deliveries of what he termed offensive weapons to Israel in the event of a full-scale invasion of the city. However, the invasion does not seem to have stalled for a lack of ammunition. For more on all of that, we go to Pittsburgh to speak with law professor and author Dan Kovalik, who has visited Palestine over the last months. Dan, what's your read of things as they are today?
Right. So right now, the Israelis are aggressively attacking Rafah. They have taken over what is known as the Philadelphia corridor of Rafah, which is on the border with Egypt. And in fact, they've taken over the Palestinian side of the border, preventing any aid from coming in and preventing any people from going out. This is, by the way, a violation of the Camp David agreements, which ended in a peace deal between Egypt and Israel. This is a violation of the peace deal. Egypt could even declare war on Israel for taking over this corridor. But in any case, my contacts in Gaza are saying there is no food or water coming in. They can't leave. I know some people even who have been cleared to leave because of medical issues that require them to get medical treatment outside of Gaza. They can't leave. And Israel is aggressively bombing the area. We have no idea how many people are dying because all of the healthcare institutions have been destroyed, and that's, of course, who counts the dead and the wounded, et cetera. But It's clearly in the hundreds and quickly will be in the thousands. Meanwhile, there's 600,000 children in Rafah who are experiencing famine conditions. They've already been weakened greatly by 7 months of war, 7 months of a siege that has prevented them from getting food and water and medicine and treatment. It's a humanitarian disaster that's happening really before our eyes.
You know, even the aid workers are getting killed.
Yes, I mean, Israel has no limits. It has no limits. Everyone in their path is being killed. And of course, there's cases of doctors that have been arrested. These are world-class surgeons been arrested and tortured to death by Israel. This is a mass slaughter, and it's unconscionable. That the world has not stepped in to stop this is really unforgivable.
You know, how you would solve this problem is mystifying to me, because there's no Palestinian state recognized by any of the parties involved. And even the attempt to so there's no one who actually can claim that they represent the Palestinian people according to the norms of diplomacy, that this is a government that's recognized as the legal government of this nation state. And consequently, they are a proper party to peace negotiations regarding hostilities between that nation state and some other nation states. Instead, you have the U.S. wants to argue in favor of the Palestinians. They want to negotiate for them because they're such an honest, fair brokers. The Israelis will even want to do that, or they want to, you know, they have already chosen the, you know, many of the members of Palestinian Authority over the last years. And this war, the genesis of this particular aspect of the war, is the 2006 election of Hamas, which Israel refused to accept, as if Israel was a stakeholder in the Palestinian state. So you have this resolution today where the, you know, 143 out of 193 nations say we want to recognize Palestine as a state and give it the rights of membership that are afforded other states. 9 countries voted against it in the General Assembly, like 25 or so abstained. I'm assuming that was Europe. I didn't look. And yet it's not going to move forward because Robert Wood assured pretty much that he's going to veto it again like he did last month when he gets to the Security Council. So who in the hell can negotiate on behalf of the Palestinian people?
Well, the truth is, whether Israel recognizes them officially or not, Israel has been and continues to negotiate with Hamas. When they sit down in Cairo, that's who they negotiate with. So Hamas is at least the de facto government of Gaza. And Israel recognizes it as such because it's negotiating with it. So that is who they need to deal with. They know that. They are doing that. And they should be negotiating a ceasefire. They should have taken the deal Hamas accepted at the beginning of the week. And instead, Hamas accepts a deal, and Israel's immediate response is to bomb Rafah on an aggressive basis.
Right. This is right after Biden tells them not to do it. And as if that there was going to be some penalty involved. You know, I don't know that it hasn't reached that level yet. I'm willing to bet, whoever wants to bet, whatever, that Israel, if they run through this whole operation to its end in Rafah, is not going to stop because they ran out of ammunition.
No, exactly. Now, the latest I saw was that Biden has said if they engage in a ground offensive against Rafah, that the U.S. would cut off military supplies to Israel. Now, that is a sea change, that he would say that. And that's good. That's positive. And he's obviously doing it in response to the protests, the mass protests in the United States. At the same time, of course, the problem is Israel's already pummeling Rafah, whether, you know, by the air, right, and cutting off all supplies and cutting off all access to leave Rafah. So the results are going to be terrible, even if they don't engage in the ground invasion. And even if they do engage in the ground invasion, the U.S. has already sent them so many supplies.
Right.
Up till now.
Right.
Including that emergency authorization for, what was it, $14 billion?
Yeah.
That they're going to have enough supplies to carry that out. So, I think it's important that Biden said that, and I think it should be counted as a victory for those protesting. And I think we need to, you know, to count our victories, right? That's important. But I'm not sure it's going to change the course of the war, because this should have happened a long time ago. This may be, in fact, too little too late. And Biden, I'm sure, knows that.
That was human rights and labor lawyer Dan Kovalik speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar.
Yeah. The people, they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and want a peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh yeah, the police. Actors and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You could pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means, a Pat Kufi and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free, but this generation here is about to cut the strings. You could ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late. We've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children, and all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the color of your pigment. But white supremacy is finally on blast, screaming free Palestine to their home at last. We see the lies and claiming it's anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist. I've seen Jewish brothers and sisters out there and writhing in solidarity and screaming free Palestine with them, organizing and learning and finally cutting ties with a state that's gotta rely on apartheid system to uphold and occupy. And violent history been repeating for the last 75. The NECPA never ended, the colonizer lied. It's students in tents posted on the lawn, occupying the quad is really against the law. And a reason to call and the police and their squad. Where does genocide land in your definition, huh? Destroying every college in Gaza and every mosque, pushing everyone in the Rafah and dropping bombs. The blood is on your hands, Biden, we can see it all. And no, I'm not voting for you in the fall. Undecided, you can't twist the truth. The people out here united, never be defeated when freedom's on the horizon. Yet the music industry's quiet, complicit in their platform of silence.
That was Macklemore. Hinds Hall. At the University of Toledo's May 2024 Graduate School Commencement Ceremony, Maha Zeidan, a Palestinian Muslim American graduating law student and the president of the Graduate Student Association, gave a timely speech calling for unity and action regarding the war on Gaza and the state of affairs in the United States.
Salaam alaikum, meaning peace be upon you all. I was born in a beautiful city in Palestine. It is for this moment and this accomplishment that my parents decided to come here and build a life here. So to my mother and father, I'd like to begin by extending my deepest gratitude for their dedication, sacrifices, and love that were cornerstone to my success, as well as my brothers and sisters who have always been there for me. I am not alone in this gratitude. Every single one of you in the audience has sacrificed for a graduate here or contributed to their success in ways that we will never forget. So thank you all. Now, it is essential to understand and acknowledge the unique journey that has brought us all to this moment in our time here. In our time here, we have witnessed profound challenges and injustices that have shaken our world like never before. We witnessed and are still witnessing an unprecedented amount of loss of innocent life in Palestine. Over the last 7 months, at least 40,000 human beings have been killed by the State of Israel. These people were not only innocent Muslims, but innocent Christians and innocent Jews as well. These people were civilians, a majority of them children. We have witnessed the demolition of one of the oldest churches in the world, of mosques, of universities, and even of designated safe zones by the United Nations. Although today is a day of accomplishments and happiness, this is a difficult reality that we must acknowledge as we proceed to the next chapter of our lives. Why, you may ask? Because we, the people, are funding these horrors with our tax dollars. Every single one of you will continue into your professional lives and be impacted by this. Consider the following. The fact that teachers, who quite literally shape our future, are paid less than an average full-time employee. or that 1.2 million veterans who put their lives on the line for this country, that they live below the poverty line, or that our top health insurance companies made nearly $69 billion in profits the same year that 68,000 Americans died due to a lack of access to health care. We are the generation that must address these issues at home. We must ask why we have sent around $320 billion in foreign aid to a state convicted of war crimes, countless violations of international law, and who are on trial for genocide, while Americans are dying due to lack of access to health care? This is the message that I want to leave you all with today, that we are the generation. A testimony to that statement is the thousands of beautiful, brave students, faculty, and administrators who are camping outside of universities demanding for a better use of our funds. If there are any of you here who feel as though you cannot relate or are uninterested in what I have said thus far, I would challenge you to consider this. Growing up, we learned about the atrocities of the Holocaust, the horrors of slavery, and we wondered, how on earth did these things happen? Well, there is a popular phrase that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So if you wonder what you would have done during those horrific times, I implore you to take a look at what you are doing right now. We are the generation that will not accept being divided based on religion or background. We will not accept unwarranted, uneducated, and hateful labels as we demand a better future for ourselves and for justice. I apologize that this is not a typical graduation speech, but there is nothing typical about the times that we are living in. There is nothing typical about 15,000 children live-streamed deaths being watched. And there is nothing acceptable about our institutional complicity, silence, or the gross misuse of police force nationwide. The world is in desperate need of change, and we must be the ones to do it. So this goes to everybody here today, my friends and family, professors, deans, and my fellow students. We must use every opportunity we have to make change, no matter how scary it is. As the graduates of today, we have an opportunity to be the heroes of tomorrow. If we look to history, we will see that the students have always been on the right side of history. The key to this is solidarity, accepting discomfort at the cost of truth, having difficult conversations to find common grounds, and working together towards salam, which, if you recall, means peace. Remember when I leave this stage that my calling was one for peace. So to not support that would not be a reflection of our UT values or our humanity. I will end by sending my salam to the struggling teachers and veterans, to my fellow Americans, to my family in Palestine, to the people of Gaza, and to all of those who are fighting for peace. Congratulations to you all, and salam.
That was Palestinian-American student Maha Zeidan speaking at the 2024 University of Toledo graduate commencement. The University of Toledo says, as a state institution, it is committed to protecting community members' First Amendment rights, including free speech, press, and assembly on all campuses. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Akua Holt, Nikichi Taifa, Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, Don DeBar, and myself, Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.